Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. We have another terrific show tonight dealing with metaphysics and spirituality. And, of course, you are invited to join in if you would like to by calling us at 877-876-5227. And if you're in Canada, how about 888-815-9756? Tonight I thought we'd deal with a subject called, by my classification or my subject, a simple proposal. I might be playing with it a little bit, but it does have to do with metaphysics and spirituality, but it also has to deal with a concept that many are familiar with, which is the ideology of democracy itself. And before we get into that, one of the people who listens to our show on a fairly regular basis, his name is Mike Run, he had a question that he called about and wanted to have me to get into, because there's a series or a show, I'm not sure which, coming out on GEO, the National Geographic Channel, dealing with how the universe is, with the known universe as it is at the present time, based upon standard physics. And I thought I would do this in the first few minutes of today's show. Maybe we'll have a whole show on it after they air that program, which would be interesting. So before we get into a simple proposal, I'm kind of switching gears on you, as I do sometimes. And I thought I'd go into this subject area, because this show deals with science. It's not just metaphysics and spirituality. It's science, too. Science, another way to look at it, science is trying to find the truth about things, but something that can be proven in some way. Doesn't have to be proven just by experiment. There's a thing called phenomenological science also. So there's all kinds of issues in science that go beyond what most people think of. Nonetheless, let's talk about our universe. And I'll try to do it in a nutshell for you, so to speak. Maybe it's a, I think that's a pun on words after I explain what I mean. Our universe really is a series of dimensions of time and space. The problem is that at the present time, the ability for traditional science, particularly physics and astrophysics, to determine that is extremely limited. And there have been some, since the discovery of some parts of quantum physics, there's been some denial of the concept that energy can and does follow thought, and thought has an effect on things, because nobody really wants to know what thought is. And also that, therefore, things like spirit and God don't make any sense because everything is based pretty much on a material outcome. And thought, spirit, God are really not part of a material universe, at least as far as most physicists are concerned. What is the interesting part about this is that thought, in metaphysical terms, in many areas of metaphysics, is actually, and this is also true of spirit, actually it's part of the mind of God, our creator. If you take the two parts together that make up God, which is like a freedom part, which is also its purpose and its creative element, and you combine that with its loving part, which is its directive planning part, its giving part, the connectivity part of the things that are choices in the first part of its mind, you join those together and you end up with thought, but the thought of our creator itself, which we call spirit. So you see how it's all interconnected. And very interestingly, it's left out of most, but not all, of modern physics. Okay, so now, what I said to begin with is that our universe is composed of dimensions of time and space, and there are seven major ones. And you might say, how come there's seven? Well, you know, I could explain it, but that would require a much longer part of the show that I don't want to devote to that. So we'll say that there are seven, and each one has a more complex part of itself. There's more parts to its dimensionality than the one that is lower in dimensionality. In other words, it has less dimensions to it. The uppermost dimension, the greatest, the largest way to define itself, has seven distinct dimensional issues. Whereas where we exist right now has only one, although we call it three. We call it three-dimensional but it is really at its, we'll say, at its heart, one dimension of time and space. And you might say, well, that's kind of confusing. Is that also metaphysics? Actually, that is, in essence, physics as we know it today, because many physicists have come to the conclusion that our three dimensions really represent one of a sort. Now, because of this confusion of there being three here, but actually it's one, and then there's each one, you add one, the next dimension of time and space has actually two, but it's four, and et cetera, then you have this questionable issue of how many dimensions are there really. Well, there's also a little quirk in that one of the dimensions is actually split that we don't even know about, and that's called the monastic or mental dimension. It actually has a higher and lower part. And because of that, it appears to be two to us when there's really one there. So if you were to count all the dimensions, it comes out to something like 10 or 11. It's something like that. And some people have come up with that number. They have actually have. Those people are usually called string theorists. Yeah. Because they're counting vibrational modes of how each dimension vibrates and creates itself and everything else. Interestingly, in metaphysics, these dimensions were supposedly created by the thought of God creating itself and creating its name. Sometimes the word name means itself. And it has seven parts to itself, seven parts to both its name. And it actually is like a vibration or sound. And if you put all seven names together, you've got the entire universe. So there's an interesting similarity between some very, very old concepts in metaphysics and some very new ones in parts of physics called string theory. But nonetheless, string theorists still are very trapped into the material side of things. And they don't get into the spiritual issues and all that. All right, the seven dimensions of time and space are ways that life can grow in complexity. Where there is only one dimensional, or three as we call them, that's height, width, and depth, dimensions, life has the most difficult time growing. And it has the most difficult time doing anything because a thing called gravity has a great effect on material things and form things, and it is very potent in the way it expresses itself. But a very interesting thing about gravity is that in one way it's very strong within our dimension, but in another way it's very weak. It's very weak because there are great distances between various atoms. The great distances causes gravity to be extremely weak. When gravity gets very close together, though, even in our dimension of time and space, it becomes inordinately strong, like inside the singularity of a black hole. Whoa, it gets real strong there. So interestingly, gravity can be one of two things. It can be either very strong or very weak, depending upon whether you're looking at it on a scale of between the distance of atoms, which is or greater, and it becomes quite weak. Or if you crunch things together, it becomes quite strong in our dimension of time and space. The interesting thing is gravity kind of does the flip side of that. As you move away from our dimension of time and space, gravity becomes in some respects much weaker, so you could just fly based upon your thought, because energy follows thought so much greater, and gravity is actually weaker, but it's weaker because between atoms there's much less space, and it's still not as strong as it is here. But if you were to flip it around, you could say, well, it looks like gravity in some respects looks stronger, based upon the reversal of our understandings of how gravity actually works. So interestingly, gravity is really getting weaker as we move away from ourselves in this dimension of time and space, but to some people it may appear to be stronger and vice versa. So at any rate, why is gravity so strong? Because gravity is the result of the thought of something called involutionary energy or matter that is joining itself together in certain ways. This matter, as I referred to it in a book I wrote in 1993, but it was published in 1999, I called dark matter. And I said that the dark matter tended to do this, and it also in some cases, would be a form of dark energy. Because in some cases, it works away from what we call gravity. In other cases, it works towards what we call gravity, because gravity exists in two different ways. If things are very well separated from each other, gravity looks extremely weak. But if it's very close together, again, it looks very strong. And so we have dark energy and dark matter, but they really are like flip sides of the way these energies are responding to the thought of our Creator. And the energies are trying to become enlightened. And as they become enlightened, they become less gravity-producing. Wow. And there's a name for this energy. It's called elemental types of energy. And it's not the elemental, it's like a being that comes and grabs you, although that's another word for that's used the same way sometimes in metaphysics. But it's the elemental type of gravity that creates elements. Okay. And that type of gravity is very different than devonic energy, which is like enlightened types of energy that produce almost no effects on gravity. What's enlightened gravity? Well, enlightened energy is made into photonic types of particles, and neutrinos are devonic because they have virtually no gravity, or in some cases none, and they respond in a way which is much more in accord with God's thought, whereas the other gravity tends not to. It tends to respond to only its own thought, and it tends to want to grab onto other parts of elemental energy and make things like planets and moons and that sort of thing and have effects on each other. Okay, maybe you're saying, well, boy, this guy's going too deep and too fast. But the bottom line of this whole thing is that they're going to discover that what they thought, they being physicists, what they thought was a clear understanding of, quote-unquote, our known universe, is that there must be other dimensions of time and space, and they must be more complex, and gravity must change there, and a thing called the standard model doesn't work there, and physics is asymmetrical, meaning that the laws are changed about the speed of light and many other issues, so that we have to have a different physics for every dimension of time and space. But we're a little ways away from getting to that point. I'd say about 20 years or so. I want to publish a book that is going to deal with this subject, because I think it will help to try to join together physics as we know it today with a lot of the metaphysics that I talk about on this show. Now, if I have lost you with all this, I went very quickly and I left out a lot of concepts because I just wanted to answer this one question and give a taste for what's coming up. So if all of you want to watch this National Geographic show, which is going to be on, I think I heard, the 15th of February in some locales, go ahead and watch it, and then maybe we can further the conversation after that point. And we all can have a discussion about it, either here or however you would like to communicate with me. Let me continue on now to a simple proposal. Oh, I love this subject. My idea is I've been watching some of the news. I've been listening, of course, for a number of years to how our political system is working or not working in both this country and some other democracies as well. I don't want to even get into the systems that are not democracies because they're mostly tainted by darkness and evil. And there's not really much to say about them except they should be gone, but they're still here. Now, we try to develop a system in our country where the first part of our Creator's mind is prominent, that is freedom and choices and creativity and a model that will allow us to live our lives being as close as we can to our Creator. But in addition to that, we want to include the second part of our Creator's thought to truly develop a spiritual thought where there is givingness and love and planning and connectivity so that we work together more rather than separatively. Instead of it just being each person for themselves type of society, it's a kind of a more, let's try to make it all for one and one for all. That's the hope of our present system. A couple of hundred years ago, human beings were just plain and simple not as conscious as they are today on the average. And they weren't as intelligent in terms of the way consciousness is used to develop intelligence unless you talk about it in other ways, which some people do. I refer to the total intelligence of a person based upon not just their ability to use knowledge and to reason within a certain period of time, but to use the reasoning in a creative way to apply it to many things that they haven't before, which is more about consciousness. And we were not a very conscious society 200 years ago compared to today, although we've grown immensely. We might have been as conscious as many societies in the world, but I'm just saying we weren't anywhere near where we are today. Each generation, which is about 20 years or so, has developed quickly the mental aspect of being able to think in greater concepts with greater truth and clarity. Now, you might say, well, how do you know that? Well, I would suggest that you really read about people and try to get a historical perspective. That doesn't mean there weren't some very, very conscious and intelligent people a couple hundred years ago. The framers, the people who created our political system, were amazingly conscious and amazingly wise people. However, they were the exception by far than the rule. Today we have a much larger proportion. I would say it could be a quarter of the population that are quite conscious. I'm not talking about, you know, they're no super wise beings, but they are far more conscious than their predecessors, than their ancestors. And so consequently, we have a new opportunity. And that's what this simple proposal is about. And I'd like you to consider this. At the present time, our political system is in a mess. We have, and have had for a long time, a very dishonest system, poisoned by greed and the seeking of power and influence peddling and you name it. And it's not getting particularly better. As a matter of fact, it's getting substantially, dangerously worse in some respects. Now, some of you say, well, what about Obama? He says he wants to make it better and everything else. Well, you know, Obama is still as much a part of the problem as he is a part of the solution. And I don't want to throw stones at him or anybody else. I think it's just important to realize that the system itself needs maybe a simple solution. And I'm going to suggest one tonight. And that solution is the following. I'm going to talk about something historically now. Over the last 10 or 15 years, one of the areas of science that has improved to some extent has been sociology and the study of the numbers of people and how people thinking. This has actually been going on for many decades, 30, 40 years, but they've gotten it down to where they can really trace it now because computers have helped a lot. And this is the question. How well does the majority of people, when they are thinking about a particular problem or question, how well do they do in comparison to experts? Experts are like, you know, a group of maybe 10, 20, 100 people who are supposed to know the best about the particular subject in comparison to millions of people who are just informed to whatever level they're informed, but making a decision collectively. How does the collective do in comparison to the experts? And this has been a question that, if you go back in time, and I said this is a little bit by history, a couple hundred years ago or more, including Rousseau, and you name all the great philosophers who were really into the individuality of man and democracy, they still believed, underneath it all, and I'm telling you the truth about this, because you can read them, they still believed, John Locke, you name them, they believed that despite all that they proposed at the time, their proposal was not so simple. Their proposal was that the masses could not be trusted, that the masses would make terrible decisions, that even though they believed, quote-unquote, in democracy of some sort, that the masses would do outlandish things because they were ignorant and uneducated and idiots, basically, and would produce devastating results on any form of society or government that was run by them totally. So they believed in a controlled democracy, which they called republic, where the masses selected those who were going to be their guardians as in a super parental role as various political names like senators, presidents, premiers, the prime minister, whatever they preferred to call them. And they tried to get away from the word king because that said that the king was there for life and these other people were there for only a temporary but sometimes protracted period of time. But they felt that was the best they could come up with because they truly didn't believe that they could trust the masses. Now, I'm not going to get into a debate about whether or not 200 years ago the masses could have run their government, because I think one would have to question whether we were ready for that, because the consciousness of people was not anywhere near what it is today. The education of people wasn't. Thanks to Jefferson and the Jeffersonian principles, we have a highly educated society. Schools became abundant, and public school became not just optional, but mandatory, supposedly, for most people. And so, consequently, we have gone through many iterations, many generations of people becoming educated to some level. And you can say, what about the people who drop out when they're in eighth grade and all this? Well, they're so much in the minority today that they don't influence the big picture, and I'll tell you why. Let's now move ahead in time and talk about what I was saying about the sociological experiments. It has been discovered, and I'm talking about this being done in numerous experiments now, more than one would likely be able to name offhand, in many different areas, that the public, we'll call it wisdom, the public level of understanding or consciousness, if you take it on a large whole scale, like millions of people, not 1,000, not even 100,000, millions of people, is greater, better, more accurate than a group of 100 experts. I know that sounds hard to believe. A lot of people go, oh, come on. No, that's what they're finding to be true. In other words, if the system is large enough, you get a condition that's called literally, it's like the cream going to the top, the best ideas, the best thought actually surfaces, and the worst thought gets suppressed in a large enough system that is open and free. Wow. And this has been tried a number of times now. Now, there are exceptions to this rule. If it's an area of such technical expertise that few people, even in the larger population, have much knowledge, and only 100 people do have knowledge about it, then it's not so much that way. No. But the good news is that in politics, that seldom is an issue. Politics is about the interrelationship of people and countries and et cetera. Even though there's some complexity to it, there is not the need to know technologically very much. As a matter of fact, if you talk to the average person in politics, you'll find technologically they're fairly ignorant, even the ones that propose to know a lot. Okay, so in politics, this may be an interesting area we could experiment with this simple proposal, which I'm going to throw out there right now, because I got about 5 minutes here, and then we're going to break. But I want you to hear this, because I want you to kind of just hear it one time, and then think about it, and then we'll come back, and I'll go into it in more detail. And that is, okay, if it is true that most of the time we can depend upon the public thinking being more accurate than those that we elect into government to do the big deciding, like for bills and for making public policy in general. I'm not talking about some guy who has, you know, a G standard, 32 or something, and goes to work every so often and does the job. You know, some people work more often than that. Some people work every day, but some of the other people don't. But at any rate, someone who's just doing a job, no, I'm not saying we're going to take over those people. I'm talking about the people we elect to office in particular. We might want to consider the following. Rather than those people being elected to make the decisions most of the time, we instead elect them to be advisors. They collectively make a decision, and then they give us opinions as they choose to. And you can get, and this is all done by the internet and computers. And you can get, or it could be done also over television in other ways, but computers are the easiest, possibly, for most people. And there's public places you can go if you don't own a computer or don't want to own one. You could still go and tune in a public place, like a library or something like that. Okay, so all the population will have access to this, and they can listen to the reports, the opinions of those that they have elected, but for most, in most circumstances, the elected officials do not vote. We vote. We are the voting body. Now, I said most. In order for us to be able to vote, there needs to be a quorum, and I think a quorum of 50% of all those people who could be voting should be voting, or we lose the right to vote, and then it goes back to the system we presently have for that those issues until a quorum is established. A quorum isn't established within 10 days in any particular issue, then it can go on and be voted upon by those we've elected. And in addition to that concept, if those that we elect come together and decide by a vast majority, we'll say a supermajority of, say, 66%, or it could be 70, whatever we choose, then we have to match. If it goes over that amount, then we have to match their vote with a vote as great. So if all the people of the country decide to override their decision, we can do so as long as it's greater than what we consider to be a supermajority on their part, which might be two-thirds or maybe 70% or whatever we decide. And then we can override them. If we can't override them, then they're again functioning more as they do today. But most of the time in this system, guess what? We're doing the voting. Most of the time in this system, we are the ultimate deciders. The people are the ultimate deciders. And this becomes a true one person, one vote, true representative, non-representative democracy most of the time, with everybody voting, hopefully, or as many people as you can to get to vote, and people becoming much more educated, because they would have to in order to vote, because otherwise they won't understand all the issues. Now you might say, well, some people will probably vote and they won't understand. But we know from the system that we've done in experiments that even when some people don't know, they get pushed out by the people who do, because our society is such that people are more conscious than not these days. Now, I grant it. We go back 100 years ago, I don't know if this would work. As a matter of fact, it probably wouldn't because we didn't have the technology. Anyway, we'll come back to all this in about, give or take, a couple of minutes, 2.5 minutes, and I want to give you some other ideas about this simple proposal.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hon, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we're talking about a simple proposal, which is the idea that simple is that I think that our present problems in government and many other areas of our country revolve around greed and issues that are so complicated to try to get out of the present, we'll say, system, it's almost impossible. So we can make laws saying, okay, you can't lobby people and then work for the government and this and that. But people always either ignore it or find some way around it, and it just doesn't seem to work. So the real problem seems to be to take the motive, which is the desire for power and control and money, greed, and remove that. So what I'm suggesting here is that we would still go through the entire federal process that we have. I like a federated process where there's each state is separate and different to some extent. So we'd still vote people in based upon exactly the same system we have. I might even say get rid of the Electoral College. I actually like that idea. Even though some people don't because it's something truly democratic, but I think it's better because it kind of brings the states to a more equal level. The smaller states get more attention because a whole election can swing on one small state, and therefore politicians have to be more nationally concerned and just go after the big states and forget about the small ones. And it gives a lot more, there's a lot of other good things about the federated system. So I want to keep that. But the idea is that just because you've been elected a senator or a congressperson or maybe even president, you aren't necessarily immediately able to do everything you want to do with that because you don't have the power and control anymore. And you're not going to be able to do much to steal money because most of the votes are coming from the folks, from the people, and not from those who can be given gifts, paid off, etc., or that just simply want the power. You know, there was a guy named Plato, many of you have heard of him, and he wrote a book called The Republic. And in that, he kind of had something similar, some ideas similar. Now, it wasn't exactly as democratic as what I just described, because they didn't have the technology. And I'm not so sure he believed that all the people were as conscious as I'm saying today, because they probably weren't. But nonetheless, one of the things that he did in his, we'll call it, proposal, was that anyone who wanted to be a part of the government and wanted to have power controlling the government had to not want the power. And he had tests for this, and he had ways of making it so that those people who were selected were the people who didn't want to serve in some ways. And who certainly didn't want power, and whose power was so limited by different ways and systems, including time, that there was just very little they could do once they were, quote-unquote, elected to be able to maintain a prolonged period of control. And my solution is simple. It actually, you don't have to change the terms, people, because a lot of people say, well, just make it a two-term thing. You know, that isn't really the solution. I mean, I like some elements about it, but then you got problems that, you know, people are, they're just run for different offices. And then you also have the fact that it sometimes helps us have somebody that's been around for a while and has some better understanding of what it is they're doing. So there's all kinds of trade-offs, but in the simple proposal, there's no trade-offs because the people we're electing don't really have very much power. Now, true, if we sit on our laurels and decide that we're not going to vote and we don't create a quorum, that gives the power back to those people who are there to do it. It's sort of like a safety net, you might say. And in addition, in my simple proposal, let's say that the safety net folks, the people we've elected, really disagree with us. And 70% of them, or 66% of them, don't want to do whatever we want. Then we've got to outvote them. We've got, as collectively, we've got to come together and say 69% or 72%, whatever, of us want something different, and then we win. And we say, okay, you guys are still advisors. We love you. We like what you're saying, but we don't agree with your vote, and that's just the way it is. So too bad. And, of course, if they don't get up to that minimum level, then our vote counts as long as we have at least half of us are voting at any one time. Another thing that this protects is the rights of the minority. Now, more might have to be addressed about this, as I think even today it needs to be. But minority rights are very critical and important, and you want to be careful that in any system of democracy, the minority still has rights regardless of what the majority thinks on its own to do. So, and that is somewhat protected by our legal system and the courts. But nonetheless, I am suggesting here that it's also protected by the quorum system and by having the advisors and the whole system, as I said, because there is some additional protection for minorities in there. This is a system in which I think we could grow tremendously, not just as a political system and get rid of a lot of our corruption, but we could start learning how to work together. You see, it's easy enough to vote one way or another, if you have a two-party system particularly, and then let everybody else fight it out in goofy ways in Washington about what we supposedly have voted for. But it's another thing to take the responsibility directly onto ourselves to educate and to become informed ourselves. Some of us will do that, some of us won't. But remember, the ones that don't, they pretty much lose out because they will be outvoted in this system. Trust me, they will be, because there are many experiments to show that they will be. And we will actually have a system in which goodness will prevail more often than not. Now, does that mean that sometimes a system might not work right? Hey, it might not. But compared to what we have today, it's got to be a world better than where we are today. Where we are, almost everything in our system is not working. And that's the scary thing. We don't have much of anything that is working. We right now are facing terrible consequences for mis or malgovernment. Basically, that's what it is. The people that we put in office in the last 10 years have been total screw-ups. These are people who have not been doing their job properly. And in some cases, they've been doing it in a very ugly and terrible way and not regulating, not doing this or that. And so the results have been terrible. Now, I'm against regulation for regulation's sake, but I'm in favor of regulating people that are greedy and selfish, and this simple proposal eliminates most of that, and therefore we don't have to have as much regulation when we don't have people abusing the system because we let them do that. Because once we elect them in our present-day mode, they can do anything they want, and they do, unfortunately. Another thing that I really like about this is that it just about eliminates every one of the arguments against the present ideas in some parts of our world, democracy. most of the people that say, oh, you got to have a strong arm, you need a, you know, you need a government that's going to crush the people who want to just have chaos and anarchy and insurrection and this and that. Well, this eliminates that. And instead, it makes those people look what they really are, which is selfish, extremely power-hungry, terribly oppressive rulers who want to subject and control others. But unfortunately, they use our present foible, the problems we have in democracies, against the democracies and make us look like idiots, because sometimes we are. I mean, you think we're winning any points with all the crazy stuff that goes on in our political system? No, I don't think so. I think it's discouraging many people from accepting that democracy is a good thing, accepting that it's good to be free, accepting that you don't want some turkey ruler telling you what to do, or a group of rulers telling you what to do and how to do it and when to do it, and they'll take half of what you own, thank you very much. But unfortunately, we're not convincing of that with what happens. And this simple proposal is a way, I hope, to get people to maybe move away from all of the negative and terrible things that are going on. Now, let's say we were to apply this. How might the future look if we were to adopt this system? Well, first of all, as I said, I wouldn't change anything about our federation. We still got the states. We've still got all the things we do, elections, the same thing. And even most of the powers that all of our elected officials have are bestowed upon them unless there is a quorum and the other conditions apply for the people to vote. The only thing that's happening here is you have to have a majority of people choosing to vote on issues. In the beginning of the system, you're not going to get a quorum very often. I know that's hard to believe, because you would say, well, isn't everybody just going to be so thrilled by it? They're all going to just, you know, sit around and listen to these people tell us things and explain things to us, and aren't we all going to vote? Well, maybe the first week or two, I don't know, maybe it'd be something new to try. But I think in general, no. As a matter of fact, I would guess that for the first few years, it would be maybe a third of the time a quorum is established on any particular subject. People will choose not to vote because they still are not conscious enough, and they're going to have to be brought to that level of consciousness by the people who are. Gradually, a quorum will be established. Whatever, if that number is 50%, I don't know what it'll be. I mean, if this is ever going to take place, of course. This is all a fantasy, I realize. But gradually, a quorum will take place where there is enough people voting so their vote counts and the votes of those elected don't. And it will only be on the most important subjects to the people at first, and then gradually less and less so, because people will start seeing, as their consciousness develops, that there's an interconnectivity between the smallest and least important to the very most important decisions that we make. And that's the truth. You see, in order to get that, you have to live it. And then as you live it, you start recognizing, and even the little small things that you say, oh, I'll just let them make their own, so you realize that everything's connected together. And if we don't decide most of the issues ourselves, the system will not work. We need it to be one where we are all connecting the dots and seeing that even small areas, things that we normally wouldn't want to really say, well, I don't really want to have a decision about that. I'll have to learn too much. I'll have to understand too much. I'm lazy. People will gradually become more conscious over time because they will gradually get it. They'll see that this is the only way it's going to work for them. And if they don't do it, they're going to have a problem. And that problem is going to be significant over time. And so this is a teaching system. It's a teaching model. It's not going to work perfectly immediately, but it should work better than what we got right now. And there's an immediate solution anytime there's a significant a disparity between the quote-unquote thought of our leaders, because they're not truly leaders unless we let them be, and ourselves. anytime there's a great difference between, now again, this isn't a popularity contest, and it's not about the votes people might make on their cell phones for a popular singer. It's so big that there's so many people potentially to vote because of this quorum thing that you're not going to get those kinds of problems where people vote for the most popular thing at the moment. You're going to get a much more serious response based upon science and sociology. This is true. And the biggest part of the problem with the system is that not enough people will vote to even create a quorum in the beginning. But once you start getting those quorums going, because people start connecting the dots and seeing they're being educated in the process, and they're saying, wow, this really works, they will be much more encouraged, particularly when they see things going awry among the elected officials that when they aren't taking control, when the people aren't taking control. And the elected officials are doing just like they're doing today. People are going to say, well, screw them. I'm getting online, and I'm going to vote right now, and I'm going to stop this crazy thing. And they'll do it. And suddenly, everybody's going to say, hey, this thing works. We're making this place a better place to live. We can still listen to our elected officials. They can still advise us. But you know what we can do? We can tell them, no, we don't like that. We're not putting that stupid amendment in that bill so that some person gets rich like you, and so others steal our money and take control of things that we don't want. You're not getting that because we're not allowing it to. And that will be a wonderful thing. Any amendment to any bill, anything like that will be within our control. We can even set up a whole series of rules of how that could take place, again, based upon the quorum principle and based upon how we function. Something can't be an amendment to a bill unless a majority of us think it should be. Oh, that would really do something to all those senators and congresspeople who use that as a system to get all kinds of ways of making money for themselves and getting reelected easily, etc. It will also force, over time, people to be more honest when they run for election because they can't just play up to the people who are going to give them things and to the people who supposedly are controlling the scenes behind the scenes, because we will ultimately have the power to stop that. Again, if we choose to. I think this is a great system. I think that it has the potential to bring us to a new level in consciousness within the country. I'm more concerned about consciousness than I am about politics. It may sound like I'm big into politics tonight, but ultimately I'm thinking about consciousness. How can we raise the consciousness of our country first, and other countries may be following suit that can create this system and produce for ourselves a new kind of world? This is one of those ways of doing it. A lot of other ways are also available, but this is one of those ways that is like hearkening to us. It's beckoning that we do something because there's so much wrong with it right now. If we can correct this, we can stop a lot of problems, and we can turn around evil, which is, it's definitely multiplying. Evil is getting worse. There's this third-rate thing that I talked about in other shows is happening. Evil is growing. It's not getting less. I don't see it. Now, maybe I'm just on the wrong side of looking at things, but that's what I see. And this is a way we can change that. We can also, so there's so many good things that could come out of this. Does it need a lot more thought and work? Oh, yeah. This is just a proposal. This isn't like the whole system. If you're going to do something about this, you got to really think about a lot of different parts of it. And there's probably all kinds of little twists and bends here that you got to make some adjustments in, et cetera. I'm just giving the big picture. But it is a way that each of us can grow in consciousness. And consciousness is the real basis for how we're going to ultimately turn out. If our world doesn't grow in consciousness significantly, and if we don't bring the people up from the ranks that aren't very conscious right now, we're going to be in much worse shape 10, 20, 30 years from now than we are at the present time. We're facing dilemmas that require very high levels of consciousness to overcome before we destroy ourselves. Some of these are man-made destructive events. Others are things that are going to happen, quote-unquote, through natural occurrences, if you call global warming a natural occurrence. But or something like that. But they're going to happen nonetheless, and we need to be planning for them and doing things in some cases to try to alter the world so that we can survive the present problems we're creating. Well, all that requires consciousness. So what I'm suggesting is that this simple proposal is actually a way of altering our future, not just in terms of government or getting rid of the bad things the government does, but in creating within ourselves a change. Just imagine how it would feel for each of us to have a sense of responsibility, but also control, over the way that we are making giant decisions in this country, virtually on a daily basis. Some of these decisions are not too bad, but a lot of them are horrible because they're seeded by too much greed and power and the desire for power and control and the desire to continue to be elected. All of those things are the motives instead of the motive to give and share, the motive to produce the creative best results that grows life, not just human life, but all life, that is helpful and beneficial, that supports God, that is a way of living that is the most wonderful and good ways that all of us can enjoy the rest of this life and other lives to come. Well, I am out of time. I hope I've given you some idea of my simple proposal. I hope it was simple enough. I just want to mention that if you happen to be in the Phoenix area coming up around February 16th, plan on coming to listen to Mimi talk about the etheric realm over at Mesa Fiesta Borders, Monday, February 16th, from 7 p.m. to 8:15 p.m. I would love for you to come and hear her talk. And then, if you have also some time this Sunday, I'm going to be doing Why Life Is on WDIS Radio. If you are in the Boston, Norfolk, Providence, Rhode Island area, I'll be on 1170 AM. And if you're not in that area, just tune into WDISAM.com from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Yeah, just do it on the Eastern Time schedule. If you're away from that Eastern Time, hey, just tune in at the appropriate hour. You know what that is. You can figure it out. And, of course, it's live. You can call in if you would like. We won't be talking about this subject, but we'll be talking about something else. You know, I've always got something on my mind. And hopefully for today's show, this has all made some degree of sense, I hope. And it has not confused you. If you want to, please email me at thoughts@whylifeis.com, and I would love to hear your comments about this subject. Maybe even suggestions. I can bring them up in another show, or you can call in any time, of course. And let me know what you think and what kind of problems you see with it, what kinds of benefits, etc. Well, we're out of time for right now, and I would like you to consider the following. The following we'll say in general. If we're going to have a better planet, and if this world is really going to become the kind of place it needs to, we need larger numbers of people to be concerned about that happening. In every way possible, this is what I call a first-rate way that I suggested in today's show, one that is more political on a large scale and nationally enhanced. But there are many other ways of doing this. Get involved with others on a group level and attempt, in whatever way you see fit, to make this a better place. Do what you can. And until next week, this has been Why Life Is, and I am Niles McFarland.